Music, session number 18362, Reel 3.
Ron Delavine, Reel 4.
One day he brought out his pipe and tobacco, rolled a ball of tobacco, put it in the pipe, gave me the pipe, left me his box of matches, went to the door of the warehouse to keep guard, turned round from the doorway and went, nodded his head, gave me the signal to smoke, and he kept watch. So I had my smoke. When I finished it, he left me enough tobacco to have another smoke, a little ball of tobacco in. I had a second smoke. I waved to him, and he came back. And once again, shh, shh, shh. No, say something. And that's how I worked with that old man, and he grew fond of me, and I grew fond of him. And then the day came that I was taken off the job because I was fit enough to carry on my ordinary job. So I didn't see the old man again until after, when the war had finished and we decided to walk through the village. I was walking with two colleagues down this street. They're all low, typical Japanese houses, you know. And who should open the door but my old friend? We went over, take our shoes off, because they match, you know, the Japanese mats. Came in, his wife was there, bowing her head, flat down, cross-legged, you know, sort of thing. And his wife brought a little round table in, and she poured out some tea, and then he told her to go. And somehow, the three of us, well, the four of us, the two fellows, myself and him, we seemed to hold a conversation. We knew, and he explained that he had hardly any food, and he pointed us out through this doorway. He had a couple of ducks there, and he must have told his wife to kill a duck and cook it. Well, I was never a meat eater, but I thought I can't upset the old man. So we sat there, you know, and he gave us passed the pipe round with the tobacco, and we had a smoke. And then he told us to have a sleep. You could sleep while his wife was cooking. I suppose he could have killed us, I don't know, but anyway, we did. I said to him, "No, I've worked with him, this is a fine old man." So he put down for them. Next thing we knew, he gently shook my shoulder, because I was the one he knew personally, and his wife came in with some, no rice, I'm very short, but some bits of vegetable, and this bit of roast duck, and that we had this meal. And then we thanked him, and we went out. And then he called, and we went back, and he said, no, you, he pointed to me. And I went back, and he gave me something, which I'll show you in a minute. He gave me this present, and I thought that was absolutely wonderful of him. He's a marvellous old man. And so amongst the stuff that was dropped to us, there were some towels, socks, blankets, you know, things that we, you know, they must have known we were lousy and wanted new stuff. So the next day I took him some blankets, you know, and the present there, the present for him. I said, just present like that. And then he gave me this present, which I'm going to show you.
Describe it in words before you show me it, so it goes on the tip.
Oh, the pipe, yes. I told you he gave me a present, did I?
Yes.
Yeah. And
it was a pipe.
And that was the last I saw of him. So I was able to return his gift. He was a lovely old man. And I remember he used to say to me when we were sitting down, what was the Japanese word for war? I've forgotten. And he used to say the war, and he'd say, "Dami," which is no good, war, "Dami," killing, "Dami." He hated it. And he was a lovely chap. I grew passionately fond of him during my working period. He was a friend, he became a friend, you know, Conrad. He became a friend. It was lovely because he was a sad, sympathetic old man that had obviously had a hard life and all that. And so, you know, and I've told that story to friends about I don't tell people these things. I just say it was a tough time, you know. And then we came, then the Americans said, well, we want you to, you are not going back via India with the rest. The United States wish to entertain 80 prisoners of war. So we flew from Japan to Okinawa. I should never forget that camp. The stench of dead. The Americans were bulldozing bodies up on the beach. You know, there were massive battles in Okinawa. And we stayed there for about a week. And then we flew from there to the Philippines. And here's another final story for us then. They said, they took us down to the airfield in Okinawa and took us into the American canteen, supplied us with coffee, donuts, and said, we're going to take you to the Philippines, lads. Now, so he came and he counted so many men there. They flew off in not a warplane, an early type of passenger aircraft, you know, I don't know what it was. Quite a big one, DC something. And then he took the second lot, and the chaps that I was in charge of, I said, look, don't let's hurry, let's enjoy our coffee and cigarette, and we'll take the last plane. So the others went off, then about half an hour later, he came in and said, okay, I think there are about 10 or 11 of us left. He said, okay, boys. And we marched out, and instead of being a comfortable plane, it was an old Liberator bomber. Still had its battle wounds on the fuselage. Always remember, big nude girl painting on the nose, you know, typical American bomber. Pilot with a big cigar, everything was so American. Big cigar, puffing away. Okay, boys. Bombay doors were open, put a ladder there, and we climbed up. Now, they'd rigged up some planks either side of the fuselage, the body. And so the pilot said, look, I'll put some blankets in the Bombay and the glass nose turret, where the bomb aimers turret. He said, two of you can lie down in there. One of you go into the rear gun turret. One of you in the upper fuselage turret. He said, and then swap around, you know, make a change. So we got in and got orders to take off. But we noticed that the Bombay doors wouldn't quite meet. They sort of flapped down. So he said, not to worry, boys, and he gave us some blankets to wrap round ourselves, you know. And we took off. We hadn't been flying for more than 10 minutes. He said, another pilot, that's a co-pilot, came back. He said, can you guys smell the gas? And yeah, it's a terrible smell, bloody fuel, you know. So he went through the plane with his torch, looking at all the pipes and God knows what. And they couldn't find it. And then suddenly it vanished. Quite suddenly, the smell of gas vanished. Fine. I was sitting in this, you know, glass nose turret. Very, very nice. Taken off. Very exciting. And then we were flying away, and suddenly the sky went as black can be. And then the hail started. The hailstones were that size of being sucked up through this split in the under the Bombay, and it was sort of cutting me. One had to keep doing this and that, and it got worse and worse, and the plane, Conrad, was bouncing, buckling, shriveling. It was doing everything so badly that the pilot came back. He put parachutes on all of us, and he said, look, lads, he said, I don't know how we're going to get out of this. He said, this is the worst ever. And he put these parachutes on, and when he got to me, he said, I'll have to give you different instructions. He said, now with this one, he said, if you have to jump, he said, as I think we will have to jump, he said, I'll open the Bombay doors, you leap out, and the other said, you pull the cord. Now he said, with you, he said, you'll pull this buckle here, he said, and you'll find, judge when you're about 30 feet above the sea, 40 feet, pull that buckle there, you'll turn upside down and you will slip out of your harness. He said, and as you're slipping, your Mae West will expand, and God bless you and help you. He He said, then, so of course, then he went back, then he came back once again, and my stomach turned over, and he's going to tell us we've got to jump. So he said, look, he said, I'm not going to do this on my own back, I'm going to consult you because it's your lives as well as ours. He said, I'm going to take a gamble. I'm going to fly down the China coast and try and avoid, we've got to get out of this storm. He said, as quick as I can. So we agreed we'd do it. So he did it. The plane go round Buckley and we cleared the storm. It was great. Then he came back again. He said, I think I've got enough fuel to get to Manila. I think. And eventually he came back. He said, we're here, boys. And we came back and he showed us the petrol. He showed us the gauge. It was virtually empty, Conrad. And he congratulated us and we congratulated him on his capability of being such a wonderful bloody pilot. And I said to him, I'll tell you this. I said, that's the last bloody plane I go in. So he said, oh, I'm sorry, bud. He said, after you've had your coffee and donuts, he said, you're going in that one for another couple of hundred miles. And we went into an old Dakota, which felt so strange after this great lumbering, vibrating bomber. And we reached, and then we got the... we stayed a couple of days in the camp there, which was upsetting. They segregated all the black soldiers in like a bloody cage, you know. It made me sick. And then we got on the newest American troop ship, the Admiral Rodman. How different to ours, you know, ice water fountains in the corridors. And when they said, chow up, boys, couldn't believe it, you know, to English soldiers' food. There were trays of fried chicken and trays of this and clam chowder soup, and all round the mess deck it was stacked high with cans of cream and evaporated milk. You know, you just helped yourself. I couldn't eat much anyway, but some did and were very ill too. And we had a long trip across the Pacific to past Hawaii. We all hoped perhaps we would do, but it was rather heaven, because on the deck the American crew rigged up a large screen and showing films at night, you know, and everybody smoking themselves to death, always wary that there might be some lurking Japanese crank in a submarine, you know, so the lookouts were always on watch. And eventually we got to San Francisco. When we passed Alcatraz, everybody went to one side of the ship and the captain gave orders to go back because the ship had gone over. And we got back to San Francisco, had a great reception there from the Americans, who showered us with gifts. When we left San Francisco after about 4 or 5 days, the presents we left on that railway station were unbelievable. Everybody gave us loads of sweets, cigarettes, clothes and that, but we just couldn't cope. We took a couple of rucksacks each. Then we took the Santa Fe Railway across the states to New York. Now, we stopped at various places. We stopped at Albuquerque. We stopped at Dodge City for about 3 or 4 hours, I think. Went into an American diner and asked for a piece of... strawberry shortcake, and the girl said, are you English boys? You know, and he said yes. And she brought out this foot and a half long tray that she cut it into 4 pieces and gave us a piece each. Imagine, you know, because we hadn't eaten a thing, you know, I couldn't eat anyway, it was so sweet and sickly. So that was Dodge City, and we went across and we stayed at Philadelphia. And when we got to Chicago, we had a big hotel reception. And I remember walking on the carpet. One's feet sank in the pile up to the ankles. Anyway, there's a great long corridor to the main dining room in the hotel. And all the way along were typical American glamour girls. Every 5 or 6 feet was a glamour girl. One would have trays of Lucky Strike cigarettes, another one trays of Powerhouse. I said, "Does your girlfriend, does she like nylons?" And I said, "I haven't got a girlfriend." "Well, take some because you might meet one." And the nylons, another one would give you this, another one would give you that, all sorts of stuff, you know. And eventually we had more kit bags to look after. And about, I said, we had about four kit bags each of gear. Then we got to New York and we stayed in an army place there. I forget what it was called. And we went to, they took us to the famous Stage Door canteen. And we arrived just after, a week before, a bomber had crashed into one of the skyscrapers. And there was a great gaping hole there, you know, killed a lot of people, apparently, of course. And there was pretty terrible, for the story. And then they wanted to take us on a tour. So I went to the guys and I said, "Look, will it, you," I said, "we're not children. Can you trust us?" I said, "Two or three of friends and I, we want to wander around. And, well, as long as you can make yourself back, and you'll be okay, sure." And so we separate. We didn't want to hang around together. Some wanted to go here and some wanted to go there. So I walked along and I saw this famous American store, Macy's, which I'd heard so much and even seen about it in old films pre-war. So I thought, I'll have a look in here. So I walked into Macy's, fantastic store. As you walk in, there's a bloody great motorboat. You can buy, they say in Macy's, you can buy a safety pin to a yacht and motorboat. And I was wandering around, and suddenly there was a tap on my shoulder. And it was an extremely wealthy-looking woman, you know, in furs. It was winter. "Are you from England? Are you an English soldier?" "Yeah." And she started asking me questions. So she said, "Young man, I want to buy you something." She said, "And when I say something, you can have from that to that." And she pointed to this bloody motorboat to that. So you must be joking. I said, "Thank you very much. Please." I said, "They would be pleased if I took that back. If you want it, I'll buy it for you," she said. "Why don't you come and live in the States?" she said. I said, "No. No," I said, "I couldn't get rid of her. She was so nice, but I wanted to get away." So eventually, I said, "Well, I'd be very pleased with that." And it was like a woolly lumberjack shirt, dark green, a check, very nice shirt. "Okay," she said, "if that's all you want." So the girl wrapped it up and she paid for it. And she said, "If you're free, come down to meet my family tonight." And she gave me some address down. So I said, "I don't think so." I said, "Because they won't let us out at night." So eventually, I thanked her again profusely. And she said, she gave me a kiss, you know, goodbye. And I was so pleased she didn't start trading addresses. I thought, I don't want to get involved, you know. That's why I never went to reunions. I don't want to get involved. And Then we got back to British jurisdiction. You are not allowed to take more than one kit bag back to England full of goods. I thought, you bastards. "Well, can we take two?" "No, one." So we raked through and sorted the best things I wanted to bring home, you know. And we got aboard the grand old Queen Mary, which had been used as a troop ship, you know, still painted grey, of course, wartime colours. And you can imagine, there were only, 250 of us, plus the crew, of course, and the officers, on that great liner capable of carrying thousands of people. And you know, Conrad, we were not allowed to go into the pink room or the green room or that room. We did all our eating and spent our evenings in a pokey little bloody place on the forecastle of the ship. That was it. And there were these great things, you know, which they wouldn't let us in. It was bloody disgusting. I was so furious. And eventually we got back to Southampton. And also, like the Americans, we had to answer questionnaires. More in America, actually, the names of various Japanese people that had been brutal to us, and so on, lots of delousing in America. And in England, there was hardly a soul to greet us. Not that I wanted it, because I'm a bit of a reclusive fellow, and always have been. I mean, worse now as I got older. And There was hardly anybody to meet us at Southampton. It was dreary, it was rainy, the food was bloody awful in the mess room. And then the great day came when we boarded the train and came to London. When I got to London, there were people there. There was none of my family to meet me. And I came from a large family. Couldn't make it out. And apparently, they'd been informed to go to the wrong station. So there were three or four of us there, you know, the waiting people from Myra. And so a WVS van came up, and the woman said, "Look, I'll run you home." And I came home, and I used to live up here and round the corner. And I went there, and of course they said, no Dedevines here. I think they live in Coston Road. So they moved here from Coston Road. And I came home. My best friend was still in the army in Italy at the time. And I wandered around, a bit fed up and lonely, and I found my father had died. And that I'd rather guess that, because they did receive one letter, a card from in Japan, that they actually allowed us to write to them. For the last 2 years, we were allowed to send a card. But you wrote what they told you. I am happy, I am well, I am healthy, so on. And then when I got this letter from home, I noticed that my father's name wasn't on it. And I thought, it's happened. So when I got home, it was a... What can I say, there was no sort of great feeling of joy at being home, No great feeling of joy. I felt so... And I was, my one great friend, it was in Italy. I went around with a couple of my brothers, were out of the army then. They came around to see me, and I went out with them a few things. I had no girlfriends then. And that was that. And then eventually, after about a year and a half, my friend was home, and we sort of bummed around and all that. And then I decided to apply. I thought I'd do another year at art school, which they granted me. And that was the end of the adventure, Conrad. And then I met my wife and so on.
Do you think that your war experiences changed you?
Changed me? Conrad, I am now in many ways... Are we recording?
Yes.
I am now in many ways... I'm very intolerant of people. Now, do you know one thing that drives me mad? I know what hunger is. I know what starvation is. I suffered it for 3.5 years. And when I see people gorging themselves and eating themselves and saying... Or people being out and they haven't had a sandwich in 2 hours and saying, "God, I'm starving! I'm starving!" Or... "Oh God, put another bar on, it's freezing." I think, you fool, you just don't know what it is. I do not like a lot of company. If you give me, for instance, if you said to me now, "Look, I'm having a little thing tonight, about four friends coming round," I'd be delighted. It's great. But you take me to offer me to a party, I refuse. I don't go to weddings. My wife goes to weddings when she's invited, or maybe a little thing. But I am, I'm alone, and all that, my two great friends, Morris and Sonny, that painter, one unfortunately lives in St Ives, the other one lives the other side of Hartford. The young man that did that, one of their sons, lives in Holloway, but I don't see him much because they've just had a baby and they're very busy. But apart from that, I went to the cinema with my nephew a couple of weeks ago to see the Titanic film. First of all, I've been to cinema for years. I don't want to go anywhere. I just don't go. I just want to shut myself up and work. Because at 79, Conrad, that maybe my years are running out, so I've got to do as much work as I can. I want to work as much as I can. Well, that's it. And thank you for the...
Thank you.